The Raven, Edgar Allan Poe. Listen to and download free AI-generated audiobooks at 3ords.com. The Project Gutenberg ebook of The Raven. This ebook is for the use of anyone anywhere in the United States and most other parts of the world at no cost and with almost no restrictions whatsoever. You may copy it, give it away, or reuse it under the terms of the Project Gutenberg license included with this ebook or online at www.gutenberg.org. If you are not located in the United States, you will have to check the laws of the country where you are located before using this ebook. Title: The Raven, author Edgar Allan Poe, commentator Edmund Clarence Stedman, illustrator Gustave Doré. Release date: November 30, 2005, ebook 17192, most recently updated December 13, 2020. Language: English. Other information and formats: www.gutenberg.org/ebook/17192. Credits: produced by Jason Isbell, Melissa Urakabi, and the online distributed proofreading team at https://www.pgdp.net. *start of the project GUTMBRG EBOOK The Raven *back cover The Raven by Edgar Allan Poe, illustrated by Gustave Doré. Title image with comment by Edmund C. Stedman, New York, Harper and Brothers, PUBLSHERS, Franklin Square, 1884. Entered according to Act of Congress in the year 1883 by Harper and Brothers in the office of the Librarian of Congress at Washington. All rights reserved. Transcriber's notes. In the list of illustrations, I restored a missing single quote after Lenore. As shown below, "Wretch," I cried, "thy God hath lent thee, by these angels he hath sent thee, respite, respite, and nepenthe from thy memories of Lenore." The list of illustrations uses visitor where the poem and the actual illustration use visitor. List of illustrations with names of engravers. Title page designed by Elihu Vedder, Frederick Juengeling. Nevermore. H. Claudius G.J. Buchner Anank. H. Claudius. Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered, weak and weary, over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore. R.A. Muller. Ah, distinctly I remember it was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. R.G. Tightsy. Eagerly I wished the morrow, vainly I had sought to borrow from my book surcease of sorrow, sorrow for the lost Lenore. H. Claudius. Sorrow for the lost Lenore. W. Zimmerman. For the rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore, nameless here forevermore. Frederick Juengeling. T is some visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door, some late visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door. W. Zimmerman. Here I opened wide the door, darkness there and nothing more. H. Claudius. Doubting, dreaming dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before. F.S. King. Surely, said I, surely that is something at my window lattice. Let me see then what thereat is, and this mystery explore. Frederick Juengeling. Open here I flung the shutter. T. Johnson. A stately raven of the saintly days of yore, not the least obeisance made he, not a minute stopped or stayed he. R. Stoddenbor. Perched upon a bust of palace just above my chamber door, perched and sat and nothing more. R. G. Tightsy. Wandering from the nightly shore. Frederick Juengeling. Till I scarcely more than muttered, other friends have flown before, on the morrow, he will leave me as my hopes have flown before. Frank French. And upon the velvet sinking, I betook myself to linking, fancy unto fancy. R. Schelling. But whose velvet violet lining with the lamplight gloating o'er, she shall press, ah, nevermore. George Cruel. Wretch, I cried, thy God hath lent thee, by these angels he hath sent thee, respite, respite, and nepenthe from thy memories of Lenore. Victor Bernstrom. On this home by horror haunted. R. Stoddenbor. Tell me truly, I implore, is there balm in Gilead? Tell me, I implore. W. Zimmerman. Tell the soul with sorrow laden if, within the distant Aden, it shall clasp a sainted maiden whom the angels name Lenore. F. S. King. Be that word our sign of parting, bird or fiend? I shrieked, upstarting. W. Zimmerman. Get thee back into the tempest and the night's Plutonian shore. Robert Hoskin. And my soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor shall be lifted nevermore. R.G. Tightsy, The Secret of the Sphinx, R. Stoddenbor. Comment on the poem, The Secret of a Poem No Less Than a Jest's. Prosperity lies in the ear of him that hears it. Yield to its spell, accept the poet's mood. This, after all, is what the sages answer when you ask them of its value. Even though the poet himself in his other mood tell you that his art is but sleight of hand, his food enchanter's food, and offer to show you the trick of it, believe him not. Wait for his prophetic hour, then give yourself to his passion, his joy or pain. we are. In Love's Hand Today, sings Gaudier in Swinburne's buoyant paraphrase, and from morn to sunset we are wafted on the violent sea, there is but one love, one May, one flowery strand. Love is eternal, all else unreal and put aside. The vision has an end, the scene changes, but we have gained something, the memory of a charm. As many poets, so many charms. There is the charm of evanescence, that which lends to supreme beauty and grace an aureole of pathos. Share with Landor. His one night of memories and of sighs for Rose. Aylmer, and you have this to the full, and now take the hand of a new world minstrel, strayed from some proper habitat to that rude and dissonant America which, as Baudelaire saw, was for Poe only a vast prison through which he ran hither and thither with the feverish agitation of a being created to breathe in a purer world, and where his interior life, spiritual as a poet, spiritual, even as a drunkard, was but one perpetual effort to escape the influence of this antipathetical atmosphere. Clasp the sensitive hand of a troubled singer dreeing thus his weird, and share with him the clime in which he found, never throughout, the day, always in the night, if not the Atlantis, whence he had wandered, at least a place of refuge, from the bounds in which by day he was immured, to one land only he has power to lead you, and for one night only can you share his dream, a tract of neither earth nor heaven, no man's land, out of space, out of time. Here are the perturbed ones through whose eyes, like those of the sensei, the soul finds windows though the mind is dazed, here spirits groping for the path which leads to eternity are halted and delayed. It is the limbo of planetary souls, wherein are all moonlight uncertainties, all lost loves and illusions. Here some are fixed in trance, the only respite attainable, others move fantastically to a discordant melody, while everywhere are sheeted memories of the past, shrouded forms that start and sigh. As they pass the wanderer by, such is the land, and for one night we enter it, a night of astral phases and recurrent chimes. Its monodies are 12 poems whose music strives to change, yet ever is the same. One by one they sound like the chiming of the brazen and ebony clock in the Mask of the Red Death, which made the waltzers pause with disconcert and tremulousness and meditation as often as the hour came round. Of all these mystical cadences, the plaint of the raven, vibrating through the portal chiefly, has impressed the outer world. What things go to the making of a poem, and how true in this, as in most else, that race which named its bards the makers? A work is called out of the void, where there was nothing, it new creation, part of the treasure of mankind. And a few exceptional lyrics, more than others that are equally creative, compel us to think anew how bravely the poet's pen turns things unknown to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. Each seems without a prototype, yet all fascinate us with elements wrested from the shadow of the supernatural. Now the highest imagination is concerned about the soul of things. It may or may not inspire the fantasy that peoples with images the interlunar vague. Still, one of these lyrics in its smaller way affects us with a sense of uniqueness, as surely as the sublimer works of a supernatural cast, Marlowe's Faustus, the Faust of Goethe, Manfred, or even those ethereal masterpieces, The Tempest and A Midsummer Night's Dream. More than one, while otherwise unique, has some burden or refrain which haunts the memory, once heard, never forgotten, like the tone of a rarely used but distinctive organ stop. Notable among them is Bouguer's Lenore, that ghostly and resonant ballad, the lure and foil of the translators. Few will deny that Coleridge's wondrous Rime of the Ancient Mariner stands at their very head. Le Jew afferent would have claims had Beranger been a greater poet, and but for their remoteness from popular sympathy, the Lady of Shalott and the Blessed Damozel might be added to the list. It was given to Edgar Allan Poe to produce two lyrics, The Bells and The Raven, each of which, although perhaps of less beauty than those of Tennyson and Rossetti, is a unique ullalume, while equally strange and imaginative, has not the universal quality that is a portion of our test. The Raven, in sheer poetical constituents, falls below such pieces as The Haunted Palace, The City and the Sea, The Sleeper, and Israfel. The whole of it would be exchanged, I suspect, by readers of a fastidious cast for such passages as these, around by lifting winds forgot, resignedly beneath the sky, the melancholy waters lie, no rays from the holy heaven come down, on the long nighttime of that town, but light from out the lurid sea streams up the turrets silently, up many and many a marvelous shrine, whose wreathed friezes intertwine the vial, the violet, and the vine. No swellings tell that winds may be upon some far-off happier sea, no heavings hint that winds have been on seas less hideously serene. It lacks the aerial melody of the poet whose heartstrings are a lute, and they say the starry choir and the other listening things that Israfeli's fire is owing to that lyre. By which he sits and sings the trembling living wire of those unusual strings. But the raven, like the bells and animal, Lee, commends itself to the many and the few. I have said elsewhere that Poe's rarer productions seem to me those in which there is the appearance, at least, of spontaneity, in which he yields to his feelings while dying falls and cadences most, musical, most melancholy, come from him unawares. This is still my belief, and yet upon a fresh study of this poem, it impresses me more than at any time since my boyhood. Close acquaintance tells in favor of every true work of art, induce the man who neither knows art nor cares for it to examine some poem or painting and how soon its force takes hold of him. In fact, he will overrate the relative value of the first good work by which his attention has been fairly caught. The Raven also has consistent qualities which even an expert must admire. In no other of its authors, poems is the motive more palpably defined. The Haunted Palace is just as definite to the select reader, but Poe scarcely would have taken that subtle allegory for bald analysis. The Raven is wholly occupied with the author's typical theme, the irretrievable loss of an idolized and beautiful woman, but on other grounds also, the public instinct is correct in thinking it his representative poem. A man of genius usually gains a footing with the success of some one effort, and this is not always his greatest. Recognition is the more instant for having been postponed. He does not acquire it, like a miser's fortune, coin after coin, but not at all or all in all. And thus with other ambitions, the courtier, soldier, actor, whatever their parts, each counts his triumph from some lucky stroke. Poe's raven, despite augury, was for him the bird that made the breeze to blow. The poet. Settled in New York in the winter of 1844-45, finding work upon Willis's paper, the Evening Mirror, and eking out his income by contributions elsewhere. For 6 years, he had been an active writer and enjoyed a professional reputation, was held in both respect and misdoubt, and was at no loss for his share of the ill-paid journalism of that day. He also had done much of his very best work, such tales as Lygia and The Fall of the House. Of Usher, the latter containing that mystical counterpart in verse of Elihu Vedder's A Lost Mind, such analytic feats as The Gold Bug and The Mystery of Marie Roget. He had made proselytes abroad and gained a lasting hold upon the French mind. He had learned his own power and weakness and was at his prime and not without a certain reputation. But he had written nothing that was on the tongue of everybody, too rare and delicate, work some popular touch must be added to. Capture the general audience of one's own time through the industry of Poe's successive biographers, the hit made by The Raven has become an oft-told tale. The poet's young wife, Virginia, was fading before his eyes but lingered for another year within death's shadow. The long, low chamber in the house near the Bloomingdale Road is as famous as the room where Rouget de L'Isle composed, The Marseillaise. All have heard that the poem, signed Quarles, appeared in the American Review with a pseudo-editorial comment on its form that Poe received $10 for it, that Willis, the kindest and least envious of fashionable arbiters, reprinted it with a eulogy that instantly made it town talk. All doubt of its authorship was dispelled when Poe recited it himself at a literary gathering, and for a time he was the most marked of American authors. The hit stimulated and encouraged him. Like another and prouder satirist, he too found something of summer even in the hum of insects. Sorrowfully enough, but 3 years elapsed, a period of influence, pride, anguish, yet always of imaginative or critical labor, before the final defeat, before the curtain dropped, on a life that for him was in truth a tragedy, and he yielded to the conqueror worm. The American Review, a Whig journal, was a creditable magazine for the time, double-columned, printed on good paper with clear type, and illustrated by mezzotint portraits. Amid much matter below the present standard, it contained some that any editor would be glad to receive. The initial volume for 1845 has articles by Horace, Greeley, Donald Mitchell, Walter Whitman, Marsh, Tuckerman, and Whipple. Ralph Hoyt's quaint poem, Old, appeared in this volume. And here are three lyrics by Poe, The City and the Sea, The Valley of Unrest, and The Raven. Two of these were built up, such was his way, from earlier studies, but the last named came out as if freshly composed and almost as we have it now. The statement that it was not afterward revised is erroneous. 11 trifling changes from the magazine text appear in The Raven and Other Poems, 1845, a book which the poet shortly felt encouraged to offer the public. These are mostly changes of punctuation or of single words, the latter kind, made to heighten the effect of alliteration. In Mr. Lang's pretty edition of Poe's verse brought out, in the parchment library, he has shown the instinct of a scholar and has done wisely in going back to the text in the volume just mentioned, as given in the London issue of 1846. The standard, Griswold collection of the poet's works abounds. With errors, these have been repeated by later editors who also have made errors of their own, but the text of The Raven, owing to the requests made to the author for manuscript copies, was still farther revised by him. In fact, he printed it in Richmond just before his death with the poetic substitution of Seraphim Whose Footfalls for Angels Whose Faint Footfalls in the 14th stanza. Our present text, therefore, while substantially that of 1845, is somewhat modified by the poet's later reading and is, I think, the most correct and effective version of the single poem. The most radical change from the earliest version appeared, however, in the volume in 1845, the 11th stanza originally having contained these lines faulty, in rhyme and otherwise a blemish on the poem, caught from some unhappy master, whom unmerciful disaster followed fast and followed faster, so when hope he would adjure. Stern despair returned, instead of the sweet hope he dared adjure. That sad answer, nevermore. It would be well if other and famous poets could be as sure of making their changes always improvements. Poe constantly rehandled his scanty show of verse and usually bettered it. The Raven was the first of the few poems which he nearly brought to completion before printing. It may be that those who care for poetry lost little by his death. Fluent in prose, he never wrote verse for the sake of making a poem. When a refrain of image haunted him, the lyric that resulted was the inspiration, as he himself said, of a passion, not of a purpose. This was at intervals so rare as almost to justify the Fairfield theory that each was the product of a nervous crisis. What then gave the poet his clue to the Raven? From what misty foundation did it rise, slowly to a music slowly breathed? As usual, more than one thing went to the building of so notable a poem. Considering the longer sermons often preached on brief and less suggestive texts, I hope not to be blamed for this discussion of a single lyric, especially one which an artist like Doré has made the subject of prodigal illustration. Until recently, I had supposed that this piece and a few which its author composed after its appearance were exceptional in not having grown from germs in his boyish verse. But Mr. Fearing Gill has shown me some unpublished stanzas by Poe written in his 18th year and entitled The Demon of the Fire. The manuscript appears to be in the poet's early handwriting, and its genuineness is vouched for by the family in whose possession it has remained for half a century. Besides the plainest germs of the bells and the haunted palace it contains, a few lines somewhat suggestive of the opening and close of The Raven. As to the rhythm of our poem, a comparison of dates indicates that this was influenced by the rhythm of Lady Geraldine's courtship. Poe was one of the first to honor Miss Barrett's genius. He inscribed his collected poems to her as the noblest of her sex, and was in sympathy with her lyrical method. The lines from her love poem, with a murmurous stir uncertain in the air, the purple curtain swelleth in and swelleth out around her motionless pale brows, found an echo in these, and the silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain thrilled me, filled me with fantastic terrors never felt before. Here Poe assumed a privilege for which he roughly censured Longfellow, and which no one ever sought, on his own premises without swift detection and chastisement. In melody and stanzaic form, we shall see that the two poems are not unlike, but in motive, they are totally distinct. The generous poetess felt nothing but the true originality of the poet. This vivid writing, she exclaimed, this power which is felt, our great poet Mr. Browning, author of Paracelsus, and C, is enthusiastic in his admiration of the rhythm. Mr. Ingram, after referring to Lady Geraldine, cleverly points out another source from which Poe may have caught an impulse. In 1843, Albert Pike, the half-Greek, half-frontiersman, poet of Arkansas, had printed in The New Mirror, for which Poe then was writing, some verses entitled Isidore, but since revised by the author and called The Widowed Heart. I select from Mr. Pike's revision the following stanza, of which the main features correspond with the original version. Restless, I pace our lonely rooms, I play our songs no more. The garish sun shines flauntingly upon the unswept floor. The mockingbird still sits and sings, O melancholy strain, for my heart is like an autumn cloud that overflows with rain. Thou art lost to me forever, Isidore. Here we have a prolonged measure, a similarity of refrain and the introduction of a bird whose song enhances sorrow. There are other trails which may be followed by the curious, notably a passage which Mr. Ingram selects from Poe's final review of Barnaby Rudge. The Raven, too, might have been made more than we now see it, a portion of the conception of the fantastic, Barnaby. Its character might have performed, in regard to that of the idiot, much the same part as does, in music, the accompaniment in respect to the air. Nevertheless, after pointing out these germs and resemblances, the value of this poem still is found in its originality. The progressive music, the scenic detail and contrasted light and shade, above all the spiritual passion of the nocturne, make it the work of an informing genius. As for the gruesome bird, he is unlike all the other ravens of his clan, from the Twa Corbies and Three Ravens of the Balladists to Barnaby's rumpled grip. Here is no semblance of the cawing rook that haunts ancestral turrets and treads the field of heraldry, no boding phantom of which Tickell sang that when shrieking at her window thrice, the raven flapped his wing, too well the lovelorn maiden knew the solemn boding sound. Poe's raven is a distinct conception, the incarnation of a mourner's agony and hopelessness, a sable, embodied memory, the abiding chronicler of doom, a type of the irreparable. Escaped across the Styx from the night's Plutonian shore, he seems the imaged soul of the questioner himself, of him who cannot, will not, quaff the kind Nepenthe, because the memory of Lenore is all that is left him, and with the surcease of his sorrow even that would be put aside. The Raven also may be taken as a representative poem of its author for its exemplification of all his notions of what a poem should be. These are found in his essays on the poetic principle, the rationale of verse, and the philosophy of composition. Poe declared that in music, perhaps, the soul most nearly attains the great end for which, when inspired by the poetic sentiment, it struggles. The creation of supernal beauty? Verse cannot be better designated than as an inferior or less capable music. But again, verse, which is really the poetry of words, is the rhythmical creation of beauty, this and nothing more. The tone of the highest beauty is one of sadness. The most melancholy of topics is death. This must be allied to beauty. The death, then, of a beautiful woman is, unquestionably, the most poetical topic in the world, and equally is it beyond doubt that the lips best suited for such a topic are those of a bereaved lover. These last expressions are quoted from Poe's whimsical analysis of this very poem, but they indicate precisely the general range of his verse. The climax of the bells is the muffled monotone of ghouls who glory in weighing down the human heart. Lenore, the raven, the sleeper, to one in paradise, and Ulalum form a tenebrose symphony, and Annibal Lee, written last of all, shows that one theme possessed him to the end. Again, these are all nothing if not musical, and some are touched with that quality of the fantastic which awakes the sense of awe and adds a new fear to agony itself. Through all is dimly outlined beneath a shadowy pall the poet's ideal love, so often half portrayed elsewhere, the entombed wife of Usher, the Lady Legia, in truth the counterpart of his own nature. I suppose that an artist's love for one in the form never can wholly rival his devotion to some ideal. The woman near him must exercise her spells, be all by turns and nothing long, charm him with infinite variety, or be content to forgo a share of his allegiance. He must be lured by the unattainable, and this is ever just beyond him in his passion for creative art. Poe, like Hawthorne, came in with the decline of the Romantic school, and none delighted more than he to laugh at its calamity. Yet his heart was with the romancers and their Oriental or Gothic effects. His invention, so rich in the prose tales, seemed to desert him when he wrote verse, and his judgment told him that long romantic poems depend more upon incident than inspiration, and that to utter the poetry of romance, lyrics would suffice. Hence his theory, clearly fitted to his own limitations, that a long poem is a flat contradiction in terms. The components of The Raven are few and simple, a man, a bird, and the phantasmal memory at a woman. But the piece affords a fine display of romantic material. What have we? The Midnight, the shadowy chamber with its tomes of forgot. Or The Student, a modern Hieronymus, the raven's tap on the casement, the wintry night and dying fire, the silken windswept hangings, the dreams and vague mistrust of the echoing darkness, the black, uncanny bird upon the pallid bust, the accessories of violet velvet and the gloating lamp. All this stage effect of situation, light, color, sound is purely romantic and even melodramatic, but of a poetic quality that melodrama rarely exhibits, and thoroughly reflective of the poet's eternal passion, eternal pain. The rhythmical structure of The Raven was sure to make an impression. Rhyme, alliteration, the burden, the stanzaic form were devised with singular adroitness. Doubtless the poet was struck with the aptness of Miss Barrett's musical trochaics, in eights, and especially by the arrangement, adopted near the close of Lady Geraldine. "Eyes," he said, "now throbbing through me. Are ye eyes that did undo me, shining eyes like antique jewels set in Parian statue stone? Underneath that calm white forehead, are ye ever burning torrid, or the desolate sand desert of my heart and life undone?" His artistic introduction of a third rhyme in both, the second and fourth lines, and the addition of a fifth line and a final refrain made the stanza of The Raven. The persistent alliteration seems to come, without effort, and often the rhymes within lines are seductive, while the refrain or burden dominates the whole work. Here also he had profited by Miss Barrett's study of ballads and romance in her own and other tongues. A refrain is the lure wherewith a poet or a musician holds the wandering ear, the recurrent longing of nature for the initial strain. I have always admired the beautiful refrains of the English songstress. The nightingales, Margaret, Margaret, my heart and I, toll slowly, the river floweth on, Pan, Pan is dead, etc. She also employed what I term the repetend, in the use of which Poe has excelled all poets since Coleridge thus revived it. O happy living things, no tongue their beauty might declare, a spring of love gushed from my heart, and I blessed them unaware, sure my kind saint took pity on me, and I blessed them unaware. Poe created the fifth line of his stanza for the magic of the repetend. He relied upon it to the uttermost in a few later poems, Lenore, Annabel Lee, Ulalume, and For Annie. It gained a wild and melancholy music, I have thought, from the sweet influences of the Afric burdens and repetends that were sung to him in childhood, attuning with their native melody the voice of our Southern poet. The philosophy of composition, his analysis of The Raven, is a technical dissection of its method and structure. Neither his avowal of cold-blooded artifice, nor his subsequent avowal to friends that an exposure of this artifice was only another of his intellectual hoaxes, need be wholly credited. If he had designed the complete work in advance, he scarcely would have made so harsh a prelude of rattle-pan rhymes to the delicious melody of the second stanza, not even upon his theory of the fantastic. Of course, an artist, having perfected a work, sees, like the first artist, that it is good and sees why it is good. A subsequent analysis, coupled with a disavowal of any sacred fire, readily enough, may be made. My belief is that the first conception and rough draft of this poem came as inspiration, always comes, that its author then saw how it might be perfected, giving it the final touches, described in his chapter on composition, and that the latter, therefore, is neither wholly false nor wholly true. The harm of such analysis is that it tempts a novice to fancy that artificial processes can supersede imagination. The impulse of genius is to guard the secrets of its creative hour, glimpses obtained of the toil, the baffled experiments which precede a triumph, as in the sketchwork of Hawthorne recently brought to light, afford priceless instruction and encouragement to the sincere artist. But one who voluntarily exposes his muse to the gaze of all comers should recall the fate of King Candles. The world still thinks of Poe as a luckless man of genius. I recently heard him mentioned as one whom everybody seems chartered to misrepresent, decry, or slander. But it seems to me that his ill luck ended with his pitiable death, and that since then his defense has been persistent, and his fame of his steadfast growth as a suffering and gifted author could pray for in his hopeful hour. Griswold's decreal and slander turned the current in his favor. Critics and biographers have come forward with successive refutations, with tributes to his character, with new editions of his works. His own letters and the minute incidents of his career are for us, the record, good and bad, is widely known. No appeller has received more tender and forgiving judgment. His mishaps in life belonged to his region and period, perchance still more to his own infirmity of will. Doubtless his environment was not one to guard a fine-grained, ill-balanced nature from perils without and within. His strongest will to be lord of himself gained for him that heritage of woe. He confessed himself the bird's unhappy master, the stricken sufferer of this poem. But his was a full share of that dramatic temper which exults in the presage of its own doom. There is a delight in playing one's high part. We are all gladiators, crying Ave Imperator, to quote Burke's matter of fact. In grief, the pleasure is still uppermost, and the affliction we suffer has no resemblance to absolute pain, which is always odious and which we endeavor to shake off as soon as possible. Poe went farther and was an artist even in the tragedy of his career. If, according to his own belief, sadness and the vanishing of beauty are the highest, poetic themes and poetic feeling the keenest earthly, pleasure then the sorrow and darkness of his broken life were not without their frequent compensation. In the following pages, we have a fresh example of an artist's genius characterizing his interpretation of a famous poem. Gustave Doré, the last work, of whose pencil is before us, was not the painter, or even the draftsman for realists demanding. Truth of tone, figure, and perfection, such matters concerned him less than to make shape and distance. Light and shade assist his purpose, which was to excite the soul, the imagination of the looker on. This he did by arousing our sense of awe through marvelous and often sublime conceptions of things unutterable and full of gloom or glory. It is well said that if his works were not great paintings, as pictures they are great indeed. As a literary artist, and such he was, his force was in direct ratio with the dramatic invention of his author, with the brave audacities of the spirit that kindled his own. Hence his success with Rabelais, with La Jeu Afferent, Les Contes Drolatiques, and Don Quixote, and hence, conversely, his failure to express the beauty of Tennyson's Idylls, of Il Paradiso, of the Hebrew Pastorals, and other texts requiring exaltation or sweetness and repose. He was a born master of the grotesque, and by a special insight, could portray the specters of a haunted brain. We see objects as his personages saw them, and with the very eyes of the wandering Jew, the bewildered Don, or the goldsmith's daughter whose fancy so magnifies the king in the shop on the Ponto Change. It was in the nature of things that he should be attracted to each masterpiece of verse or prose that I have termed unique. The lower kingdoms were called into his service. His rocks, trees, and mountains, the sky itself, are animate with motive and diablerie. Had he lived to illustrate Shakespeare, we should have seen a remarkable treatment of Caliban, the witches, the storm in Lear, but doubtless should have questioned his ideals of Imogen or Miranda. Beauty pure and simple and the perfect excellence thereof he rarely seemed to comprehend. Yet there is beauty in his designs for the ancient Mariner, unreal as they are, and a consecutiveness rare in a series by Doré. The rhyme afforded him a prolonged story with many shiftings of the scene. In The Raven, sound and color preserve their monotone, and we have no change of place or occasion. What is the result? Doré proffers a series of variations upon the theme as he conceived it, the enigma of death and the hallucination of an inconsolable soul. In some of these drawings, his faults are evident, others reveal his powerful originality and the best qualities in which, as a draftsman, he stood alone. Plainly there was something in common between the working moods of Poe and Doré. This would appear more clearly had the latter tried his hand upon the tales of the grotesque and arabesque. Both resorted often to the elf land of fantasy and romance. In melodramatic feats, they both, through their command of the supernatural, avoided the danger line between the ideal and the absurd. Poe was the truer worshiper of the beautiful. His love for it was a consecrating passion, and herein he parts company with his illustrator. Poet or artist, death at last transfigures all within the shadow of his sable harbinger. Vedder's symbolic crayon aptly sets them face to face, but enfolds them with the mantle of immortal wisdom and power. An American woman has wrought the image of a star-eyed genius with the final torch, the exquisite semblance of one whose vision beholds, but whose lips may not utter, the mysteries of a land beyond the door of a legended tomb. Edmund C. Stedman, the poem, illustration 1, The Raven. Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered, weak and weary, over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping, rapping at my chamber door. "Is some visitor," I muttered, "tapping at my chamber door? Only this and nothing more." Ah, distinctly I remember it was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. Eagerly I wished the morrow. Vainly I had sought to borrow from my book surcease of sorrow, sorrow for the lost Lenore, for the rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore, nameless here forevermore. And the silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain thrilled me, filled me with fantastic terrors never felt before, so that now, to still the beating of my heart, I stood repeating, "Is some visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door? Some late visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door? This it is, and nothing more." Presently my soul grew stronger, hesitating then no longer. "Sir," said I, "or madam, truly your forgiveness I implore, but the fact is I was napping, and so gently you came rapping, and so faintly you came tapping, tapping at my chamber door, that I scarce was sure I heard. I opened wide the door. Darkness there, and nothing more. deep into that darkness peering, long I stood there wondering, fearing. Doubting, dreaming dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before, but the silence was unbroken, and the darkness gave no token, and the only word there spoken was the whispered word, Lenore. This I whispered, and an echo murmured back the word, Lenore. Merely this and nothing more. Back into the chamber turning, all my soul within me burning. Soon again I heard a tapping, somewhat louder than before. Surely, said I, surely that is something at my window lattice. Let me see then, what thereat is, and this mystery explore. Let my heart be still a moment, and this mystery explore. T is the wind and nothing more. Open here I flung the shutter, when, with many a flirt and flutter, in there stepped a stately raven of the saintly days of yore. Not the least obeisance made he, not a minute stopped or stayed he, but with mien of lord or lady, perched above my chamber door. Perched upon a bust of Pallas just above my chamber door. Perched, and sat, and nothing more. Then this ebony bird beguiling my sad fancy into smiling, by the grave and stern decorum of the countenance it wore. Though thy crest be shorn and shaven thou, I said, art sure no craven. Ghastly, grim, and ancient raven wandering from the nightly shore. Tell me what thy lordly name is on the night's Plutonian shore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Much I marveled this ungainly fowl to hear discourse so plainly, though its answer little meaning, little relevancy bore, for we cannot help agreeing that no living human being ever yet was blessed with seeing bird above his chamber door, bird or beast upon the sculptured bust above his chamber door, with such name as Nevermore. But the raven, sitting lonely on the placid bust, spoke only that one word, as if his soul in that one word he did outpour. Nothing further than he uttered, not a feather than he fluttered, till I scarcely more than muttered, other friends have flown before, on the morrow he will leave me as my hopes have flown before. Then the bird said, nevermore. Startled at the stillness broken by reply so aptly spoken. Doubtless, said I, what it utters is its only stock and store. Caught from some unhappy master whom unmerciful disaster followed fast and followed faster till his songs one burden bore, till the dirges of his hope that melancholy burden bore, of never, nevermore. But the raven still beguiling all my sad soul into smiling. Straight I wheeled a cushioned seat in front of bird and bust and door. Then, upon the velvet sinking, I betook myself to linking. Fancy unto fancy, thinking what this ominous bird of yore, what this grim, ungainly, ghastly, gaunt, and ominous bird of yore, meant in croaking nevermore. This I sat engaged in guessing, but no syllable expressing. To the fowl whose fiery eyes now burned into my bosom's core, this and more I sat divining, with my head at ease reclining, on the cushion's velvet lining that the lamplight gloated o'er, but whose velvet violet lining with the lamplight gloating o'er, she shall press, ah, nevermore. Then methought the air grew denser, perfumed from an unseen censer, swung by seraphim whose footfalls tinkled on the tufted floor. Wretch, I cried, thy God hath lent thee, by these angels he hath sent thee, respite, respite, and nepenthe from thy memories of Lenore. Quaff, O quaff this kind nepenthe, and forget this lost Lenore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, whether tempter sent, or whether tempest toss thee here ashore. Desolate yet all undaunted, on this desert land enchanted, on this home by horror haunted, tell me truly, I implore, is there balm in Gilead? Tell me, I implore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Prophet, said I, thing of evil, prophet still, if bird or devil, by that heaven that bends above us, by that God we both adore, tell this soul with sorrow laden, if within the distant Aden, it shall clasp a sainted maiden whom the angels name Lenore, clasp a rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore. Quoth the raven, nevermore. Be that word our sign of parting, bird or fiend. I shrieked, upstarting, get thee back into the tempest and the night's Plutonian shore. Leave no black plume as a token of that lie thy soul hath spoken. Leave my loneliness unbroken. Quit the bust above my door, take thy beak from out my heart, and take thy form from off my door. Quoth the raven, nevermore. And the raven, never flitting, still is sitting, on the pallid bust of Pallas just above my chamber door, and his eyes have all the seeming of a demon's that is dreaming, and the lamplight o'er him streaming throws his shadow on the floor, and my soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor shall be lifted, nevermore. Illustration 2, Illustration 3. Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered, weak and weary, over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore. Illustration 4. Ah, distinctly I remember it was in the bleak December, and each separate dying ember wrought its ghost upon the floor. Illustration 5. Eagerly I wished the morrow. Vainly I had sought to borrow from my book Surcease of Sorrow, Sorrow for the Lost Lenore. Illustration 6. Sorrow for the Lost Lenore. Illustration 7. For the rare and radiant maiden whom the angels name Lenore, nameless here forevermore. Illustration 8. Is some visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door, some late visitor entreating entrance at my chamber door. Illustration 9. Here I opened wide the door, darkness there and nothing more. Illustration 10. Doubting, dreaming dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before. Illustration 11. Surely, said I, surely that is something at my window lattice, let me see then, what thereat is, and this mystery explore. Illustration 12. Open here I flung the shutter. Illustration 13. A stately raven of the saintly days of yore, not the least obeisance made he, not a minute stopped or stayed he. Illustration 14. Perched upon a bust of Pallas just above my chamber door, perched and sat and nothing more. Illustration 15. Wandering from the nightly shore. Illustration 16. Till I scarcely more than muttered, other friends have flown before. On the morrow, he will leave me as my hopes have flown before. Illustration 17. Then upon the velvet sinking, I betook myself to linking fancy unto fancy. Illustration 18. But whose velvet violet lining with the lamplight gloating o'er, she shall press, ah, nevermore. Illustration 19. Wretch, I cried, thy God hath lent thee, by these angels he hath sent thee. Respite, respite, and nepenthe from thy memories of Lenore. Illustration 20. On this home by horror haunted. Illustration 21. Tell me truly, I implore. Is there balm in Gilead? Tell me, I implore. Illustration 22. Tell the soul with sorrow laden if within the distant Aden it shall clasp a sainted maiden whom the angels name Lenore. Illustration 23. Be that word our sign of parting, bird or fiend. I shrieked, upstarting. Illustration 24. Get thee back into the tempest and the night's plutonian shore. Illustration 25. And my soul from out that shadow that lies floating on the floor shall be lifted nevermore. Illustration 26. End of the project GUTMBRG EBOOK The Raven asterisk. Updated editions will replace the previous one. The old editions will be renamed, creating the works from print editions not protected by U.S. copyright. Law means that no one owns a United States copyright in these works, so the Foundation and you can copy and distribute it in the United States without permission and without paying copyright royalties. Special rules set forth in the general terms of use part of this license apply to copying and distributing project. Gutenberg trademark electronic works to protect the project GUTMBRGTM concept and trademark. Project Gutenberg is a registered trademark and may not be used if you charge for an ebook, except by following the terms of the trademark license, including paying royalties for use of the Project Gutenberg trademark. If you do not charge anything for copies of this ebook, complying with the trademark license is very easy. You may use this ebook for nearly any purpose, such as creation of derivative works, reports, performances, and research. Project Gutenberg ebooks may be modified and printed and given away. You may do practically anything in the United States with ebooks not protected by U.S. copyright law. Redistribution is subject to the trademark license, especially commercial redistribution. Start full license, the full Project GUTMBRGTM license. Please read this before you distribute or use this work to protect the Project Gutenberg trademark mission of promoting the free distribution of electronic works by using or distributing this work or any other work associated in any way with the phrase Project Gutenberg. You agree to comply with all the terms of the full Project Gutenberg license available with this file or online at www.gutenberg.org/license. Section 1. General Terms of Use and Redistributing Project Gutenberg Electronic Works. 1A. By reading or using any part of this Project Gutenberg electronic work, you indicate that you have read, understand, agree to, and accept all the terms of this license and intellectual property trademark copyright agreement. If you do not agree to abide by all the terms of this agreement, you must cease using and return or destroy all copies of Project Gutenberg electronic works in your possession. If you paid a fee for obtaining a copy of or access to a Project Gutenberg electronic work and you do not agree to be bound by the terms of this agreement, you may obtain a refund from the person or entity to whom you paid the fee as set forth in paragraph 1E8(1)(b). Project Gutenberg is a registered trademark. It may only be used on or associated in any way with an electronic work by people who agree to be bound by the terms of this agreement. There are a few things that you can do with most Project Gutenberg electronic works, even without complying with the full terms of this agreement. C. Paragraph 1C below. There are a lot of things you can do with Project Gutenberg electronic works if you follow the terms of this agreement and help preserve free future access to Project Gutenberg electronic works. See paragraph 1E below 1C. The Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the Foundation or PGLAF, owns a compilation copyright in the collection of Project Gutenberg electronic works. Nearly all the individual works in the collection are in the public domain in the United States. If an individual work is unprotected by copyright law in the United States and you are located in the United States, we do not claim a right to prevent you from copying, distributing, performing, displaying, or creating derivative works based on the work as long as all references to Project Gutenberg are removed. Of course, we hope that you will support the Project Gutenberg mission of promoting free access to electronic works by freely sharing Project Gutenberg works in compliance with the terms of this agreement for keeping the Project Gutenberg name associated with the work. You can easily comply with the terms of this agreement by keeping this work in the same format with its attached full Project Gutenberg license when you share it without charge with others. 1D. The copyright laws of the place where you are located also govern what you can do with this work. Copyright laws in most countries are in a constant state of change. If you are outside the United States, check the laws of your country in addition to the terms of this agreement before downloading, copying, displaying, performing, distributing, or creating derivative works based on this work or any other Project Gutenberg work. The Foundation makes no representations concerning the copyright status of any work in any country other than the United States. 1E. Unless you have removed all references to Project Gutenberg. 1E1. The following sentence, with active links to or other immediate access to the full Project Gutenberg license, must appear prominently whenever any copy of a Project Gutenberg work, any work on which the phrase Project Gutenberg appears or with which the phrase Project Gutenberg is associated, is accessed, displayed, performed, viewed, copied, or distributed. This ebook is for the use of anyone anywhere in the United States and most other parts of the world at no cost and with almost no restrictions whatsoever. You may copy it, give it away, or reuse it under the terms of the Project Gutenberg trademark license included with this ebook or online at www.gutenberg.org. If you are not located in the United States, you will have to check the laws of the country where you are located before using this ebook. 1E2. If an individual Project Gutenberg electronic work is derived from texts not protected by U.S. copyright law, does not contain a notice indicating that it is posted with permission of the copyright holder, the work can be copied and distributed to anyone in the United States without paying any fees or charges. If you are redistributing or providing access to work with the phrase Project Gutenberg associated with or appearing on the work, you must comply either with the requirements of paragraphs 1E1 through 1E7 or obtain permission for the use of the work and the Project Gutenberg trademark as set forth in paragraphs 1E8 or 1E9. 1E3. If an individual Project Gutenberg electronic work is posted with the permission of the copyright holder, your use and distribution must comply with both paragraphs 1E1 through 1E7 and any additional terms imposed by the copyright holder. Additional terms will be linked to the Project Gutenberg license for all works posted with the permission of the copyright holder found at the beginning of this work. 1E4. Do not unlink or detach or remove the full Project Gutenberg license terms from this work or any files containing a part of this work or any other work associated with Project Gutenberg. 1E5. Do not copy, display, perform, distribute, or redistribute this electronic work or any part of this electronic work without prominently displaying the sentence set forth in paragraph 1E1 with active links or immediate access to the full terms of the Project Gutenberg license. 1E6. You may convert to and distribute this work in any binary, compressed, marked up, non-proprietary, or proprietary form, including any word processing or hypertext form. However, if you provide access to or distribute copies of a Project Gutenberg work in a format other than plain vanilla ASCII or other format used in the official version posted on the official Project Gutenberg website, www.gutenberg.org, you must, at no additional cost, fee, or expense, To the user, provide a copy, a means of exporting a copy, or a means of obtaining a copy upon request of the work in its original plain vanilla ASCII or other form. Any alternate format must include the full Project Gutenberg license as specified in paragraph 1E1, 1, E7. Do not charge a fee for access to, viewing, displaying, performing, copying, or distributing any Project Gutenberg works, unless you comply with paragraph 1E8 or 1E9, 1, E8. You may charge a reasonable fee for copies of or providing access to or distributing Project Gutenberg electronic works, provided that you pay a royalty fee of 20% of the gross profits you derive from the use of Project Gutenberg works calculated using the method you already use to calculate your applicable taxes. The fee is owed to the owner of the Project Gutenberg trademark, but he has agreed to donate royalties under this paragraph to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. Royalty payments must be paid within 60 days following each date on which you prepare or are legally required to prepare your periodic tax returns. Royalty payments should be clearly marked as such and sent to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation at the address specified in Section 4, Information about donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. You provide a full refund of any money paid by a user who notifies you in writing or by email within 30 days of receipt that s/he does not agree to the terms of the full Project Gutenberg trademark license. You must require such a user to return or destroy all copies of the works possessed in a physical medium and discontinue all use of and all access to other copies of Project Gutenberg trademark works. You provide, in accordance with paragraph 1F3, a full refund of any money paid for a work or a replacement copy if a defect in the electronic work is discovered and reported to you within 90 days of receipt of the work. You comply with all other terms of this agreement for free distribution of Project Gutenberg trademark works. 1. E9. If you wish to charge a fee or distribute a Project Gutenberg trademark electronic work or group of works on different terms than are set forth in this agreement, you must obtain permission in writing from the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the manager of the Project Gutenberg trademark. Contact the foundation as set forth in Section 3 below, 1, F1, F1. Project Gutenberg volunteers and employees expend considerable effort to identify, do copyright research on, transcribe and proofread works not protected by U.S. copyright law in creating the Project Gutenberg trademark collection. Despite these efforts, Project Gutenberg trademark, electronic works, and the medium on which they may be stored may contain defects, such as, but not limited to, incomplete, inaccurate, or corrupt data, transcription errors, a copyright or other intellectual property infringement, a defective or damaged disk or other medium, a computer virus or computer codes that damage or cannot be read by your equipment. 1F2. Limited warranty disclaimer of DAMAGES, except for the right of replacement or refund described in paragraph 1F3, the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the owner of the Project Gutenberg trademark, and any other party distributing a Project Gutenberg trademark electronic work under this agreement, disclaim all liability to you for damages, costs, and expenses, including legal fees. You agree that you have no remedies for negligence, strict liability, breach of warranty, or breach of contract, except those provided in paragraph 1F3. You agree that the foundation, the trademark owner, and any distributor under this agreement will not be liable to you for actual, direct, indirect, consequential, punitive, or incidental damages, even if you give notice of the possibility of such damage. 1F3. Limited right of replacement or refund. If you discover a defect in this electronic work within 90 days of receiving it, you can receive a refund of the money, if any, you paid for it by sending a written explanation to the person you received the work from. If you received the work on a physical medium, you must return the medium with your written explanation. The person or entity that provided you with the defective work may elect to provide a replacement copy in lieu of a refund. If you received the work electronically, the person or entity providing it to you may choose to give you a second opportunity to receive the work electronically in lieu of a refund. If the second copy is also defective, you may demand a refund in writing without further opportunities to fix the problem. 1. F4. Except for the limited right of replacement or refund set forth. In paragraph 1F3, this work is provided to you as is, with no other warranties of any kind, express or implied, including but not limited to warranties of merchantability or fitness for any purpose. 1. F5. Some states do not allow disclaimers of certain implied warranties or the exclusion or limitation of certain types of damages. If any disclaimer or limitation set forth in this agreement violates the law of the state applicable to this agreement, the agreement shall be interpreted to make the maximum disclaimer or limitation permitted by the applicable state law. The invalidity or unenforceability of any provision of this agreement shall not void the remaining provisions. 1. F6. Indemnity. You agree to indemnify and hold the foundation, the trademark owner, any agent or employee of the foundation, anyone. Providing copies of Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works in accordance with this agreement and any volunteers associated with the production, promotion, and distribution of Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works, harmless from all liability, costs, and expenses, including legal fees that arise directly or indirectly from any of the following which you do or cause to occur. A distribution of this or any Project Gutenberg work, B. Alteration, modification, or additions or deletions to any Project Gutenberg work, and C. Any defect you cause, Section 2. Information about the mission of Project Gutenberg. Project Gutenberg is synonymous with the free distribution of electronic works in formats readable by the widest variety of computers, including obsolete, old, middle-aged, and new computers. It exists because of the efforts of hundreds of volunteers and donations from people in all walks of life. Volunteers and financial support to provide volunteers with the assistance they need are critical to reaching Project Gutenberg goals and ensuring that the Project Gutenberg collection will remain freely available for generations to come. In 2001, the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation was created to provide a secure and permanent future for Project Gutenberg and future generations. To learn more about the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation and how your efforts and donations can help, see Sections 3 and 4 and the Foundation Information page at www.gutenberg.org, Section 3. Information about the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. The Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation is a nonprofit 501c3 educational corporation organized under the laws of the state of Mississippi and granted tax-exempt status by the Internal Revenue Service. The foundation's EIN or federal tax identification number is 64622-1541. Contributions to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation are tax-deductible to the full extent permitted by U.S. federal laws and your state's laws. The foundation's business office is located at 41 Watchung Plaza 516, Montclair NJ 7042, USA, +1-862-621-9288. Email contact links and up-to-date contact information can be found at the foundation's website and official page at www.gutenberg.org/contact, Section 4. Information about donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. Project Gutenberg trademark depends upon and cannot survive without widespread public support and donations to carry out its mission of increasing the number of public domain and licensed works that can be freely distributed in machine-readable form accessible by the widest array of equipment, including outdated equipment. Many small donations, $1 to $5,000, are particularly important to maintaining tax-exempt status with the IRS. The foundation is committed to complying with the laws regulating charities and charitable donations in all 50 states of the United States. Compliance requirements are not uniform, and it takes a considerable effort, much paperwork, and many fees to meet and keep up with these requirements. We do not solicit donations in locations where we have not received written confirmation of compliance. To send donations or determine the status of compliance for any particular state, visit www.gutenberg.org/donate. While we cannot and do not solicit contributions from states where we have not met the solicitation requirements, we know of no prohibition against accepting unsolicited donations from donors in such states who approach us with offers to donate. International donations are gratefully accepted, but we cannot make any statements concerning tax treatment of donations received from outside the United States. U.S. laws alone swamp our small staff. Please check the Project Gutenberg web pages for current donation methods and addresses. Donations are accepted in a number of other ways, including checks, online payments, and credit card donations. To donate, please visit www.gutenberg.org/donate, Section 5. General information about Project Gutenberg Electronic Works. Professor Michael S. Hart was the originator of the project. Gutenberg concept of a library of electronic works that could be freely shared with anyone. For 40 years, he produced and distributed Project Gutenberg ebooks with only a loose network of volunteer support. Project Gutenberg ebooks are often created from several printed editions, all of which are confirmed as not protected by copyright in the U.S. unless a copyright notice is included. Thus, we do not necessarily keep ebooks in compliance with any particular paper. Addition, most people start at our website, which has the main PG search facility, www.gutenberg.org. This website includes information about Project Gutenberg, including how to make donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, how to help produce our new ebooks, and how to subscribe to our email newsletter to hear about new ebooks. This is the end of the audiobook. Thank you for listening. You can listen to and download more audiobooks at threeords.com.